Welcome to New Human Living Radio Show, bringing you powerful interviews to awaken the power in you. Learn more at newhumanliving.com. And now your host, Les Jensen.
So what's the magic pill going to be? What's going to turn this rodeo around? Is it academics? Or is it religion? Or perhaps spirituality? Where's the holy grail? Where's the magic pill? What's it going to be? We're clicking off time, and I don't know where you could hide on this planet and not be exposed to the every flavor of crazy that's going on here on planet Earth. But what's going to do it? What's the pivot point, the fulcrum, the leverage that humanity will use, or perhaps God will use, or perhaps our saviors will use? Who's going to use what? Are we clear about that? Are we waiting for a savior? Are we waiting for God, Goddess, the big G, the big G? What's it going to be? I think our individual persona, you have one, I have one, this body experience that we have, is metaphorically perhaps similar to the collective consciousness. And, you know, if you got junk in your trunk, if you have karma in your subconscious, and your days are struggle and turmoil, you got to kind of go through you go through the mess to come out the other side. I mean, how many people say, well, you know, magic divinity, wipe away my emotional struggles, my emotional turmoil, pull me from the chasm of suffering and despair that I find myself in. That's kind of wanting to leapfrog the lesson, don't you think? I don't want to learn about emotions. I don't want to understand emotions. Can we just bypass that part? Is there a magic escalator? You know, I think we should get into it because I'm excited for tonight's show. We have a wonderful guest tonight. The topic tonight is the name of our guest's latest book, Hope and Heart: A Quantum Leap into the Aquarian Age. And our guest tonight is Phoenix Rose. Is the quantum going to be what saves us? Holy quantum, Batman. Is quantum going to be the permission slip that we need for what, miracles? For us to embody our divinity? I don't know. What do you think? I think we should get to it because I'm excited for our guest tonight. Again, the topic is Hope and Heart, A Quantum Leap into the Aquarian Age. Again, it's the title of our guest's latest book. It was written by our guest, Phoenix Rose, 50 years a student of metaphysics, a longtime Rosicrucian amateur astrologer and lover of science and nature. Her book is an inspirational, multifaceted poetry and prose anthology about love, nature, optimism, self-reflection, and a new understanding of consciousness and science through quantum physics. Join me in welcoming our guest to the show tonight. Welcome to the show, Phoenix.
Hello there, Les. Glad to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Yeah. Well, I really like this book you've written. It's
Thank you very much.
Quantum and Aquarian in the same sentence. Okay, right there, that's new and different.
Well, my book kind of different in that it's got poetry in the first part, and that's divided into six themes, like nature, going within, innocence, reflection, love, and joy, I think. And then the second part of the book is prose, and the centerpiece of that is a piece that I wrote called Quantum Hope, A Paradigm Shift in Consciousness. And that's all about the quantum thing, which I, in layman's terms, try to explain what the real scientists have studied. And go ahead.
How do you see quantum? I mean, quantum is kind of a new term it might have been around in the scientific and academic arenas, but when we use the word quantum as it relates to perhaps consciousness or spirituality, and in your example, the Aquarian Age, how does quantum change the dynamics of things?
Well, first of all, I think that we are at a crossroads in society and the world, and that a new worldview is on the horizon. Quantum physics has been around for over 100 years, but it's not been well understood. And Niels Bohr, one of the early quantum physicists, said, if you're not confused when you first encounter quantum physics, you cannot possibly have understood it. So even the scientists are puzzled about this, and they're juggling all kinds of different balls of opinion on what it means. And there are the mainstream scientists who mostly don't like a lot of the ideas that some of the theoretical quantum physicists are suggesting, which is that quantum physics is changing the world. The world isn't really as fixed and as real as we have imagined it to be, or we've been told and educated that way. You know, remember all the atoms that we used to study and the shells and all that? Well, anyhow, there are differing opinions about it. And part of this also means that when you look at something and you look away and look back again, there will have been a change in the something that you looked at, if it's a chair, for example, because the atoms are continuing to move. We know from Einstein that every mass is energy and energy is mass. And it's very complicated to try. And I'm not a scientist. I'm certainly not a physicist. I did take physics in high school, but I think I learned more philosophy there than anything. So we know that energy manifests in many ways. You've got solar light energy, there's kinetic energy, thermal heat energy, static energy. The mainstream scientists follow Sir Isaac Newton's laws of physics. That's the basis of what the world is that we see. It's the macro, everyday world. It's objective, and it's predictable, and we're comfortable with it. We're at home there. We're relaxed. We know the order is there. Then quantum physics came along, and this deals with the micro world of subatomic particles, the little bitty things that you can't possibly see, let alone control. and it denies objectivity, and it deals with what is only probable. And there were many questions and paradoxes when they were first looking at this, and science cannot have paradoxes because that means there's something wrong with the premise.
Right.
For example, you could, you know, how could a subatomic wave, which is something that's spread out, also be a particle which is in one specific place? So they just couldn't agree on this. And the Industrial Revolution that began later in the 1800s gave rise to the confidence that the world was arranged in an orderly fashion. But quantum physics was upsetting that notion. And then as far back as 1934, quantum physicist James Jeans, who was a contemporary of Einstein, said that the world seemed less like a giant machine and more like a giant thought. You know, this was starting to sound more like what mystics used to say. And people from the West or the Eastern sciences. In more recent years, Irvin Laszlo, who is an eminent thinker and was a two-time nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, said, "Quantum physicists revive an ancient wisdom. We are all connected to our participation in the world's one consciousness." You know, we hear that often now, that all is one. And immaterial consciousness is being shown to be the unifying factor.
Well, you were just talking about Amit Goswami. We've had him on the show a couple of times, but it seems like what you were saying, that the mystics, I can't remember the term you used, but the spiritual teachings of the past that have told us that we are all one, for the quantum to come along, especially with Western science hot on its tail, so to speak, it's giving our mind, our ego, a way to comprehend that our reality isn't as rigid and predefined as it seems, but rather it's pliable with our consciousness itself, it seems. So the quantum is perhaps a new languaging or a new understanding that our minds can comprehend. A mechanism for miracles to unfold. The idea that it's done unto us as we believe. And so before quantum came along, the world was rigid. I mean, it was kind of cut and dried and put in a book, and we all read the same metaphorical book, and we all agreed that it's rigid and static, and then quantum comes along and says, "Oh no, 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 no!
Right.
So, the title of your book, "Hope and Heart." How does hope and heart? How are those mechanisms that we can interact with the viability of the quantum realm?
Well, when I created the book and envisioned the cover, which has a single atom on it, and in the center of the atom, that is single atom, there is a heart-shaped opening rose, and this is all symbolic. The atom is the scientific aspect, the human, the physical aspect of ourselves, and the heart in the center, instead of a nucleus, it's the soul. It's the opening, unfolding soul. So it's it represents the duality of humanity. And of course, 400 years ago, there was that split when René Descartes, that caused a split. He was a philosopher back then. That was a big shift. And so that was when we had the people that believed, that followed religion, and the people on the other side that followed science. And we've kept the two of them apart ever since. And it seems to me that this resurgence of an understanding that we're getting from the study of quantum physics, has the potential to reunite the mind and the body, because, as I was going to say, that theoretical quantum physicist Amit Goswami, and it's great that he was on your show, he's an amazing man, he and other theoretical quantum physicists have proven that consciousness, not matter, is the ground of all being. You see, mainstream science says that everything is physical. Everything comes from something smaller. So you, back when he was alive, you had Stephen Hawking, most people know of him. They were seeking a unified theory of everything. And they kept searching for smaller and smaller subatomic particles. And it turns out, according to theoretical quantum physicists, that they don't have to get smaller particles. We're talking about consciousness. It was this euphoric, an aha moment that Amit Goswami had when he realized that it was consciousness. If there's only consciousness in the universe, then that gets rid of there's always been this argument about mind and body being separated, and there's no need, you know, how do they interact? If you have a physical thing and a non-physical thing, and that's the hang-up that science has had. And by saying that all is one and all is a different level, one level or another of consciousness, then that eliminates that issue. There's no duality.
I like that.
Uh-huh.
So if consciousness is the underlying fabric of all that is, so to speak, mm-hmm. and perhaps the quantum, I mean, because in a mild tangent, if I imagine, I mean, we're told that we all have angels and whatnot. If my angels are sitting here watching me have this physical experience, and I have this table, and to me the table is hard and real, but to my angels, I'm dreaming. None of this is physical. None of this is real, so to speak. And it seems like consciousness is the perhaps activator or the reality creator of this physical experience that we're having, and our minds get lost in the world outside of us, in all this physicalness, when in truth it's the root of our consciousness. I like what you said about the soul. It's the root of our consciousness that brings reality into form, if that makes sense.
Well, if we're supposed to be made in the image of God, to me that image is that we are creative beings. That we're thinking, we have the ability to create and manifest things. God is said to have created the world in 7 days, and I'm not sure that's exactly how it works, but regardless, it's we're creative beings, and we have responsibility on Earth, because this is our school of learning. This is our format for learning, our schoolyard, if you will, is the Earth. We have this opportunity to create good things, but we have to be careful of what we think. because thoughts are things as well. There's an amazing poem written by a lady back in the early 1900s, I believe. Her name is Eliza Wilcott, Eliza Wilton, and she wrote a poem. And I have a brief stanza that she said. The poem was called, "Bear With Me."
No problem.
Dear. It's in the beginning of my book here, and I actually have it memorized, but I'm not thinking clearly here. It's called "You Can Never Tell," and this is one stanza from that poem, if I may read that.
Sure.
You can never tell what a thought will do in bringing you hate or love. For thoughts are things, and their airy wings are swifter than carrier doves. They follow the law of the universe. Each thing must create its kind. They follow the track to bring you back whatever went out from your mind. So we need to be careful what we think, because we can create good or we can create ill. What we send out comes back at us. Life is a cycle. It's a circle, and I just caution people to think wonderful thoughts, be happy, laugh a lot, but
be mindful of our thoughts.
Be very mindful of our thoughts, because they are energy, a different kind of energy. So, and there's so many. I think there are still many aspects of energy yet to be found. They talk about fields, quantum fields. Gravity has a field, and there's a magnetic field, and I think there are more fields that we'll be hearing about.
Well, you've given some new definitions of the term hope and heart as acronyms. You can imagine a hope. You wrote that hope is holding only positive expectations. I like that. And heart, as harmonious empathy always rings true.
Yes. Well, I wrote the book partly because we've been through such stressful times in the beginning of the 2020s. And it's been like I wanted to inspire people to look within themselves, because the answers are there. We have the ability to, through meditation and self-examination. And Socrates said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And I try to follow that. it's good to reflect on and look within and meditate and learn what we're really about.
Right.
And it can take a lifetime. Maybe several.
I was curious about your bio, because it talks about a Rosicrucian order. Can you tell us about that and your experience with it?
Yeah, the Rosicrucian order. Well, first of all, let me just say that I've been a student of the Rosicrucian order, actually 49 years, coming up on, I joined in 1975, and it is not a religion. It sounds like it might be the Rosicrucian, Rose and Cross, but it's an educational, philosophic, non-dogmatic, cultural, humanitarian, charitable organization. It's composed of online home studies, of natural and universal laws of nature and the universe, and we learn to apply these in a practical manner. This has been added to over the centuries by many, many people as new knowledge came forward, because a mystic is always willing to move on from old thoughts to fresher new ones when new truth and understanding becomes available. So it's not a religion, as I said. There are people from all faiths of the world and all walks of life we work hard at the self-reflection that I mentioned, and trying to build our psychic abilities. And we work, and these can actually lead to strengthening inner peace for ourselves, understanding, and true success and happiness. It's an ancient organization. There's a traditional and there's an historical history. And the traditional goes back to the ancient mystery schools of Egypt. And people were trying to understand the mysteries of life, and hence the term mystery schools. So, but then in the early 1700s, it was actually brought from Egypt to Europe by philosophers like Pythagoras and Thales and the Roman philosopher Plotinus and others who had traveled to Egypt and were initiated there. It is an initiatic order. And then they brought that knowledge back to Europe where it spread. And then it spread to Europe and England. And Sir Francis Bacon, in his book, The New Atlantis, there was a group that sailed to America of Rosicrucians, and they landed in Philadelphia, and that was back in 1694. So that was their first entrance to the Americas. And then moving up to the 1915, there was a gentleman named H. Spencer Lewis, who was from New York, but he went to France with his father, and he was initiated there, and he was deemed eligible to and given the responsibility to oversee the Rosicrucian order to bring it to North America. And this gentleman, H. Spencer Lewis, through him, the teachings were first put into written form, but now they're all online and disseminated in that manner. So it's an interesting study, and I hope I mentioned that I don't represent the Rosicrucian order's position in my book, but I can only give my interpretation and understanding of what they present.
I find it curious because you were saying that it was termed the mystery school, and fast forward to here and now. If we take the quantum leap to here and now, we have the quantum physics, which is way out of our comprehension from a five senses sort of way. And so the quantum is telling us that this reality is much more pliable than what we might have thought. And the Rosicrucian order talks about the mystery school. Do you think the mystery they were talking about is actually quantum physics?
Oh, that's something to look into. I don't know that I would have expressed it that way. Who knows exactly what their understanding is? I think that the Egyptians had a much more profound understanding than is currently known, but they had obviously limited resources, and they didn't have electric lights or, you know, any microscopes or anything like what we have today. But they had their methods, and maybe they were more mentally attuned and used those faculties to a greater extent than we even think of doing today, most of us.
Well, even the pyramids or some of the sculptures are made out of extremely large single stones that we even in our modern age, you know, you were saying, well, they didn't have electricity and microscopes, but they sure kicked our butts when it came to to building pyramids, moving around extremely large stones even to the point that we can't comprehend how we would do that today, and we call ourselves modern. I just find it curious that the difference between the two. I mean, we come into the quantum vernacular and vocabulary, and we look to understand the nonlinear aspect of the quantum realm. I think that's what struck me about your book, because to talk about hope and heart, a quantum leap into the Aquarian age, I mean, we're certainly at a pivot point. I mean, the Aquarian age has been prophesized for a very long time now, and it seems like we're coming around the bend and we can see the Aquarian age starting to form. It's a most curious time to be alive.
It's an exciting time, and I think there are great changes. We're on the threshold of those, and you know, as you mentioned, I've studied astrology many years ago, and I still study astrology, but I don't do it in a predictive way. I do it in terms of cycles and psychology and personality, and I find it very helpful for timing of things. And Shakespeare even said, I think it was in Julius Caesar, that there is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the tide, brings success or health, wealth or something like that. And so it's known that the timing of things can be critical. And so that's how I find astrology is useful. But things are definitely changing, and change is hard. Change is really all there is. Death and taxes and change. I think you should add the third one to that.
Right.
To that. So this quantum thing, though, is really interesting, because they're saying that this pool, this consciousness, there's a pool or a field of potentiality that's like a DNA soup waiting to happen, because it's outside time and space. And it's only, you know, you probably, many of your listeners have probably heard of the double slit experiment, where, you know, the wave comes through and, you know, it makes patterns and I'm not a physicist, so.
Well, the double slit says.
It becomes matter. It becomes just briefly in these experiments, but it does become matter. So it's creative. It's a creation. And I find that absolutely fascinating.
Well, the idea behind that, if I understand it correctly, is the atom per se is a probability until a consciousness observes it. And then it comes out of the wave form, so to speak, and the wave collapses into a solid or a physical realm. So if indeed our consciousness is what brings about, you were talking about a field of possibility or probability, I can't remember which term you used.
Right.
It's our...
Yes.
And you talked about being mindful and how our thoughts are a vehicle of creation, then perhaps to take our mind away from the physical world we see in a metaphorical way, like we see struggle, we see suffering, we see these things in manifestation. But if our minds stay in those thoughts, we perpetuate what we don't want. So to bring our, kind of what you said about hope, to bring our positive expectations, our positive thoughts to that field that has not been manifest yet, for us to seed that field with our positive expectations is a precursor to the creation of those expectations.
I think that was very well said. And well, I concur.
Well, I'm trying to articulate what you're saying here over time. There's quite a bit of poetry in the book. What is it about poetry that you like writing poetry?
Oh, goodness. It's a freedom. It's just a chance to express. You know, if one doesn't speak well or doesn't feel like speaking well, it's nice to be able to put down your thoughts into a format that is expressive. And I try to let my inner self lead me with that and be open to sometimes a stream of consciousness work, but not always. Sometimes a poem or even an artwork, if one is painting, it can be overworked. And the trick is to know when to put the pen or the brush down. But there's a spontaneity and, as I said, a sense of freedom and a taking a flight to, it's a birthing process, really, to capture a memory, a feeling, an emotion, and to transition that to pen and paper. It's a challenge, but, you know, it sometimes is inspiring. Some people get inspired to go for a hike or to build a bridge or something like that, and I like to write.
What inspires you to start a new poem? I mean, how do poems get birthed in your world?
Well, sometimes it's just being inspired by something in nature. Other times, like if I'm sitting in my study, as I am now, I play ocean sounds in the background, or being at the beach is even better, but I don't have that really handy right away much of the time. So if you're at the beach, though, it's the smells and the sounds and maybe the sand that you're feeling and the breeze blowing and the birds and all the senses that come to life and the waves breaking on the beach or against rocks. And it's a place to meditate and be calm and allow for a dreaminess or even an altered receptive state to possibly come to me. There's a cleansing too with all that, but it all depends upon the energy of what I'm writing or experiencing or feeling at the moment. But I love nature, and many of my poems are about nature. I've lived in many places, but I like being outside probably best of all. We are all part of nature, and we cannot ever get away from her. Every breath we take should remind us that she is life itself.
Nice. So is this your first book then?
It's my first published book. I had written a book of poetry earlier, but they all have my own art in them as well. But I've written a book that was just for like a family heirloom type thing. So
nice.
This is my first
book. You did the art in the book?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I like it. And book is it's not your traditional format. It looks like it's a square, like about 9 inches by 9 inches, and it's
coffee table books.
Right.
But it's also an e-book. It's an e-book as well.
So do you see yourself writing another book?
You never can tell. I might someday, I never say never, I might write a memoir of some kind, but that we'll have to see.
Now, you dedicated this book to humanists, ecologists, and spiritually minded persons with the hope this will one day include everyone. Can you expand on that?
Yes, of course. A humanist considers all humanity as one family. It doesn't matter, irrespective of race, religion, ethnicity, or any other seeming difference. The humanist typically is open-minded and a self-reflective person and tolerant of differing opinions They want the greater good of all people through ethical living. And the humanist is typically happy to see others succeed, along, of course, with their own progress. The ecologist is the person that sees Earth as a living planet, an entity that is alive. Humans, in general, respect life, and ideally, I think we should be taking better care of Gaia, as the ancient Greeks called the creative mother goddess of Earth. We've seen so many storms, wild storms and crazy weather, fires, floods, droughts, volcanoes, melting polar ice. Yet I guess some people still doubt that the climate is changing. And yes, it's probably changed before, but there's no evidence that humankind's industrial revolution was around back to trigger it before this. And in terms of the spiritually minded individual, that individual knows that we are dual in our nature, that we have an inner self as well as our physical self. We've got a spiritual side as well as a physical side. The spiritually minded person is trying to develop their psychic self, and that probably includes meditation and self-reflection, gratitude, prayer, service to others, for example. As I see it, we are social animals, and we are all walking the very long, hard road of life. And we can make that walk a little bit easier by recalling and trying to understand that we have more in common than may divide us. I have a short poem that I'd like to read, if I may. It's called
Sure.
Peace, it's a word poem, and by that it means that each letter of the poem's title begins a new line of the poem, peace. Peace begins with centering the self. Earth roots humanity to the same strivings. Air is the breath of God we share. Charity for one another can begin with a smile. Egos subdued, our higher selves prevail.
Nice. Very nice. Well, now, what made you write this book? I mean, what do you hope the readers will gain or learn from your book?
Well, I hope that they learn to trust in themselves, to figure out that they have the answers within themselves. And an example of that, if you think of the story of Dorothy in Oz, she and her companions were trying to find their way home, and they were all looking for something that they didn't have. And they actually already had those things. This is really a metaphysical metaphor for going within, because Dorothy had the slippers on her feet that she had them all the time she was in Oz, and she could have just clicked her heels and gone home. So she had what she needed, and the Scarecrow and the Lion and the Tin Man each had the courage and the heart and the brain that they all thought that they lacked. But they had what they needed. So that's one thing I want people to understand, is that to listen to their intuition, to be open to new ideas. Aquarian age is ushering in a new world view of understanding and how the universe works, and we mustn't be afraid. Things may not be as real as we think, but it shouldn't cause us worry, because change, although it's challenging, is what life is all about. But I hope that my poetry and prose are calming and soothing as we go through this passage. And one reader told me that each of my poems was like a separate meditation, which I just loved.
Nice. Well, an hour can go by pretty fast. Can you share with our audience where they can get your book and your website and anything else you want to share?
Thank you. Okay. Yes, a couple things. My book is in soft print, but it's also in e-format, and the website, my website is www.phoenixrose.ca, phoenixrose.ca. And all online booksellers like Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Kindle, I think, Indigo, Chapters, Kobo, as well as my publisher, BalboaPress.com. And by the way, all proceeds go to humanitarian organizations, climate, wetlands, food banks, shelters, animal rescue, et cetera. I want to pay it forward. I've been blessed so much in my life that I just wanted to do something for others. And one other thing that you mentioned, Amit Goswami, the theoretical quantum physicist, wrote a review of my book. Here it is, I got it. He said, as the author has asked and answered the question in the affirmative, will science and God ever be united under a common paradigm? In the same vein, I have been asking the question, will poetry and science ever be united in the same brain and heart? Now I know that my question has also been answered in the affirmative in this book. Congratulations to the author for this wonderful book. Readers, if you want to be inspired, this book is it. Amit Goswami, PhD, author of Self-Aware Universe and about 15 other books.
Right. Well, Phoenix, we're pretty much out of time. I want to thank you for being our guest tonight. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Les. It's been my privilege and pleasure and honor, and I wish the best to you and all of your listeners. Thank you so much. Blessings and peace profound.
We've been talking with Phoenix Rose, and the topic tonight is the title of her latest book, Hope and Heart, A Quantum Leap into the Aquarian Age. So she was sharing with us how our thoughts bring the change, if you will, that our thoughts, our expectations are that vehicle of change. So I'd like to ask you, the listener, if you could daydream a world, a community, a city, a village, whatever, if you could daydream a wonderful place for you to live now, what would that look like? Perhaps we could even use the term heaven. What would heaven on earth look like? We don't have to use that term, but I think you're getting the idea I'm poking at, in that if our thoughts create, if our expectations create, and we don't know what we want to create, well, the value and the power of those thoughts and expectations fall short of their potential. To get clear, about what we would prefer, I can throw ideas out because I've been thinking about this for a while. I think part of our karmic struggles are these gigantic, monolithic, pyramid-shaped structures. For example, currency, money, dinero, dollars, whatever you want to call it. We have this single currency, and we hang everything on it. The house we live in, the vacations we take, the type of education we can afford. And then here in the United States, we gamble at the value of that money. Are you kidding me? I mean, since we have this single mechanism, money, we have these gigantic crashes, huge crashes, huge. The housing crisis of 2008, the recession, the depression of the 1930s, where the value of the money crashed and the entire country crashed with it. So what about a culture that didn't use a single currency? I think that's where the conundrum is. The pyramid structure is it's typically a single modality. What if we just barter amongst ourselves and there was no one currency that was common to all our interactions? That's one example. Another example is instead of a pyramid, a honeycomb. We just talked about the pyramid of a single currency and where the currency goes, all of humanity goes. Talk about a karmic train wreck. But what about honeycomb? In that, where I get what I need in a basic and fundamental way comes from within 5 or 10 miles of where I live. What I need in a fundamental way, food, shelter, electricity, whatever, can be sourced from within 5 to 10 miles. See, the power for our cities typically comes from tens to hundreds of miles away. We have these big transmission lines. And maybe it's Hoover Dam or some hydroelectric place. And that's making all the electricity. There's a pyramid right there, a singular mechanism, right? And so we all hang our houses on the grid. We hang our livelihood on this single source of electricity. And yet lately we've found more and more ways to develop electricity. Solar, wind, whatever. But the idea that what I need to sustain my life, I can find within 5 to 10 miles of my house. And that really draws a simple image of a honeycomb, where we're each at the cell of our own honeycomb, this little cocoon of resources. And if I go 100 miles away, there's whole different cells of honeycombs. And what if one honeycomb crashes and burns for whatever reason, metaphorically, it doesn't tip the whole boat over. Well, bam, I like that. That's resiliency. That's sustainability. That's really a vitality where you can create what you need within 5 or 10 miles of where you live. And what I'm saying isn't really new. Maybe in the 1940s or the 1930s, that was kind of the mechanism. I mean, in a general way. But then big corporations, big power companies, whatever, you know, they buy out, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And now we got this monolith. Now we have this singular source. It doesn't serve us. If you look at the faces of corporations, how many how many big corporations have really a monopoly on whatever their services are. There's just like computers, there's just a handful of operating systems, there's whatever. I mean, I think having multiple sources, multiple unique and separate sources for what we need would serve us. Anyway, so back to you, the listener. What does your heaven on earth look like? Clean air, clean food, clean water, vitality, happiness, laughter, dance, music, song, compassion, love, prosperity, etc. I'm stirring your brain because it's us, the human beings, that are going to decide what we're going to create in this next chapter of our human story. And it'd be just swell if we could get mindful about that. So hopefully that's helped you start thinking about, well, what do you want? What do you want? Hey, you can follow us at, at newhumanliving.com. I'd write a weekly blog. They're all there. This podcast has been going on for 14-plus years. There's well over 500 episodes online free. You know, next time you go to commute to work or catch a plane, just call up some of these episodes and listen to some of these interviews. We've had some fantastic guests on the show. I'm on Twitter as Les Jensen. Imagine that. Not imagine that as part of the name. Let me rephrase this. I'll be more articulate. I'm on Twitter as Les Jensen. You can follow me there I want to thank you, the listener, for showing up for yourself. Here we are at the end of the episode, and here you are too. Thank you for showing up for yourself. We've got some great guests lined up for the shows coming down the pike, and I think you're going to enjoy them. I'm your host, Les Jensen. Always a pleasure. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Jeep owners love a good snowy, muddy March. And if you're one of those mud-slinging, donut-spinning, back-road-loving Jeep people, you need to visit my friends at Johnson Auto Plaza. Find your perfect Jeep during the Jeep Celebration event all March, or shop online at johnsonautoplaza.com. Johnson Auto Plaza, selling clean cars to dirty drivers for over 30 years. Just north of E-470 on Highway 85, johnsonautoplaza.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.